You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
So, Peter is talking to us tonight about what he calls giving an account. Chapter 3, verse 15. Always be prepared to give an answer to anyone who asks you, okay? To give an answer or to give an account, to make a case. This is the word apologia. We get apologetics from this. It's often used, like when Paul was before Festus, he stood up and gave his defense. That's the word. Be prepared to give an answer to anyone who asks you for the reason for the expectation you have. But do this with gentleness and respect. So reason, our belief, when we believe something, it has a reasonable basis. There's still faith there because it's not inescapable. It's not like impossible not to believe. And no matter how good the evidence is, some people are able to say, well, I still don't believe it. But irrational faith, blind faith, where people are just like, well, I just believe that. And you're like, why? Well, I don't know. It just seems right. It's fideism, which is also blind faith. No reasonable basis. That's not what we hold to. Ask yourself this question. What's a good reason why you would believe in something? How about because your parents or someone else told you to believe in it? I don't know. I feel like that's pretty lame, actually. What if you were born to KKK members? You think you're going to get solid truth from them just because they're your parents? There's got to be some way to check on what you're being told. Not so good. How about because believing it makes you feel better? Well, okay. Also kind of lame. For one thing, all the time that you're trying to believe in this, you know in your heart that you made it up because it makes you feel better. It's not actually true. Or is it that your friends believe in it? So now we're just going to conform and follow the crowd. Who says they have it right? You could argue that the majority are often in the wrong. I'll suggest a good reason. Let's see what you think about this. Why a good reason for believing in something? How about because it's true? There's a good reason right there. And if you know with certainty or near certainty if something is true, then you believe it. You know, people didn't used to think the world was round. They used to think it was flat. The evidence started coming in. You know, finally, Magellan sailed around the whole thing. And so you don't find too many flat earthers around today. There are a few, actually. But evidence is pretty good. Satellite photography, yeah, I'm satisfied. It's true. Okay, tonight we're asking ourselves, what reason do we have for believing in Jesus, for believing in the Bible or in the biblical worldview? We'll find that there's multiple lines of evidence that converge on the same conclusion. It's not just one line of evidence. None of them are inescapable. None of them are impossible to deny. But as the layers and more evidence piles up, it becomes more and more persuasive. So we, for instance, have an argument based on the origin of the universe. Scientists tell us today that there was nothing, and then all of a sudden, boom, there was everything. And for no known reason. Why would something like that happen? It really calls for something outside of the universe. The universe can't cause itself when it doesn't even exist. It's got to be someone outside the universe, outside a, you know, extra-dimensional being that caused that to happen. Especially when you study cosmological fine-tuning and see how narrow the possibilities were for the origin of the universe. The existence of the soul, something all of us sense, points to a personal creator because it's a non-material soul, able to think, able to reason freely, not machine-like. fulfilled prophecy. This is a big one. Jesus pointed to this one often himself and said, you know, everything the prophets have written about me has to come to pass. So God set it up here with these prophecies hundreds of years before Jesus, and they all came to pass during his life. A number of key historical arguments that have to, like, a lot of people think one of the strongest arguments is the argument for the resurrection of Christ based on historical evidence. Argument from comparative religion, kind of complicated. Several presuppositional arguments which have to do with inability to match your starting point with your conclusion, and that tension is there for every worldview except the biblical worldview. And the argument from design is pretty good too. That's really good. Let's look at that one tonight. Let's focus in on a little short argument from design. The argument from design goes, if we can detect design, then there must be a designer. It's not real complicated. And another promise is, a premise is that our world manifests design. We can see unmistakable design in our world. The particular area I want to focus on is origin of life. Here we have life on this planet. And at some point it had to start. Scientists tell us that it started very early, almost 4 billion years ago, when the Earth was only half a billion years old. And 4 billions of years, it was single-celled life. Still, single-celled life. Massively complex, designed all the way. And this is the case I want to make for you tonight. Remember, a living organism has to be able to reproduce itself, self-propagation. Oh, so much goes into that. For a cell to duplicate itself within itself and then to hive off another cell, we will only be able to touch lightly on it, unfortunately. They have to be, a living organism has to be able to feed, to take in nutrients, has to be able to metabolize that food into energy for the cell, and use it for fabricating proteins, carbohydrates, lipids, and nucleic acids, the four basic components of cellular life. And a lot goes into that. And all of this, the ability to do this, requires information at a massive scale. And of course, our cellular information is stored in our DNA. DNA found in everywhere we go, all throughout time, the code is always the same. How could this have ever happened on its own when the different parts of the living cell depend upon each other? Okay, to understand this argument, let's look here as a pile of cut granite blocks suitable for building. We're going to take some big Bangalore mines, bombs, and stick them underneath this pile and then set them off, and it will blow the granite pieces up in the air. Then they'll fall back to earth, and when they hit, they'll come down roughly in this configuration. Right? I just showed this to Max, my 8-year-old grandson, the other day. That ain't gonna work. That'll never work. Yeah. I think we probably all know that. Why not? Well, it's because the Taj Mahal is based on massive amounts of information. There were plans drawn up. The workmen had to be shown where to put the blocks, how to shape them, how to fit them together. This is not an unplanned, random thing, right? And we all know that. So what's the difference? There is no difference, really, between this illustration and the idea of life coming into existence by itself. In fact, the only difference is that it would be much more likely that we would get that than that we would get life. Now people will come in and say, oh yes, but we're going to run the experiment 100 billion times. And eventually we'll get that. No, that's not true either. Doesn't matter. You won't get anything. Even if one block fell down on top of another, then you could be like, see, it could happen. No, the information is lacking. The material, the building material is there. The energy is there to move it, to bring it into collision. But what is going to channel the energy into the work of a specified building like this? That's the information right there. That's where the information comes in. What you would get if you set those blocks off is something like this, a blast pattern. And you would get it, if you did it a billion times, you'd get the same thing. A billion times, look very similar every time. We get no closer to the Taj Mahal. So, even the least complex life we know of, it requires extreme levels of information. And that information is non-material. It's an important thing to remember. Information can be recorded on a material substance, like writing on a paper, but the information isn't the ink or the paper. The information is your thoughts put onto the paper. The information has to be functional and related to the task at hand. And it can't just be random information. It has to be focused on a purpose. And biologically significant polymers, these huge molecules that make up life, never occur on their own. They never can replicate themselves apart from life. I'm going to give us a couple of short clips tonight and argue that this origin of life is implausible, not believable, unless it was designed and put there by a creator, an infinite personal God. This guy's name is Dean Kenyon. He's a professor of chemistry and the author of a standard graduate text on organic chemistry and origin of life called Chemical Predestination. Him and his co-author were working on the possibility that maybe there are properties that make amino acids join together to form proteins without the direction from DNA and RNA to do so. And he was an agnostic scientist, eventually started to critique his own view and realized it wasn't true. Here's his story.
It's an enormous problem how you could get together in one tiny submicroscopic volume of the primitive ocean all of the hundreds of different molecular components you would need in order for a self-replicating cycle to be established. And so my doubts about whether amino acids could order themselves into meaningful biological sequences on their own without pre-existing genetic material being present just reached, I guess for me, the intellectual breaking point sometime near the end of the decade of the 70s.
As Kenyon reevaluated his theory, new biochemical discoveries further weakened his conviction that amino acids could have organized themselves into proteins.
The more I conducted my own studies, including a period of time at NASA Ames Research Center, the more it became apparent that there were multiple difficulties with the chemical evolution account. And further experimental work showed that amino acids do not have the ability to order themselves into any biologically meaningful sequences. The more I thought about the alternative that was being presented in the criticism and the enormous problem that all of us who worked on this field had neglected to address, the problem of the origin of genetic information itself, then I really had to reassess my whole position regarding origins.
With computer animation, we can enter the cell to view this remarkable system at work. After After entering the heart of the cell, we see the tightly wound strands of DNA, storehouses for the instructions necessary to build every protein in an organism. In a process known as transcription, a molecular machine first unwinds a section of the DNA helix to expose the genetic instructions needed to assemble a specific protein molecule. Another machine then copies these instructions to form a molecule known as messenger RNA. When transcription is complete, the slender RNA strand carries the genetic information through the nuclear pore complex, the gatekeeper for traffic in and out of the cell nucleus. The messenger RNA strand is directed to a two-part molecular factory called a ribosome. After attaching itself securely, the process of translation begins. Inside the ribosome, a molecular assembly line builds a specifically sequenced chain of amino acids. These amino acids are transported from other parts of the cell and then linked into chains often hundreds of units long. Their sequential arrangement determines the type of protein manufactured. When the chain is finished, it is moved from the ribosome to a barrel-shaped machine that helps fold it into the precise shape critical to its function. After the chain is folded into a protein, it is then released and shepherded by another molecular machine to the exact location where it is needed.
This is absolutely mind-boggling to perceive at this scale of size such a finely tuned apparatus, a device that bears the marks of intelligent design and manufacture. And we have the details of a immensely complex molecular realm of genetic information processing. And it's exactly this new realm of molecular genetics where we see the most compelling evidence of design on the earth.
Yeah. Kenyon became a believer. The things that they were just showing in that video have all been discovered within the past few decades. Kenyon was actually a teacher while these things were being discovered and how DNA worked, RNA, the ribosomes, each of those requiring each other. The ribosomes can produce any protein, but they have to have instructions. The instructions have to come from DNA. DNA has the information, but it can't do anything with it. It depends on the ribosome. So it's an interlocking system that's like a closed loop. This guy is named James Tour. He's a professor of organic chemistry at Rice. Also an agnostic, not a believer in God, but he also changed his mind, and in part because, you know, he's really focused on synthetic organic chemistry and this question of the origin of life. He realizes as an expert in this field how implausible that really is.
I'm a synthetic organic chemist. Origin of life is purely synthetic organic chemistry. There's no way around it. I'm perfectly situated to be commenting on this, to be critiquing the origin of life research. The chemicals that are needed for life are more than just carbon and water. The structures that are needed, one needs the amino acids. The amino acids then have to hook together to form proteins. It's not easy to get amino acids to hook together. One can get very small amounts if you just add a catalyst to it, but the yields are extremely low. There are many activation steps that are needed to get this efficiently. In nature, in biology, once you have life, this is all done with nature's little nanomachines called enzymes. But what we're talking about is prebiotic, long before enzymes themselves are made, and the enzymes themselves are made out of the amino acids and proteins. Then after we have the amino acids, we've got to have the carbohydrates. The carbohydrates are another class of molecules. And then you have to hook the carbohydrates together. The carbohydrate hooking together pattern is extremely complex. Just the carbohydrate, the simple carbohydrate, D-mannose. If you just make 6 units of that D-mannose can be hooked together in over 1 trillion different combinations, depending on how they're branched and what the constitution is of the primary linkage point. Over 12 trillion combinations, and only one works. Only one will work. How do you get that? Now, you also have to have the lipids. The lipids have to have 2 tails, not one. If you have the monoacyl lipid, that destabilizes any lipid bilayer. And these also have chiral centers. Again, how is that done in a prebiotic system? Nobody knows. And then you have to have the nucleic acids. So you have to have the nucleobases, and those nucleobases have to somehow hook very cleanly to a carbohydrate that had to independently be made, and then you have your nucleotide that then with a phosphate group on there that then has to hook together. Again, that's only done by enzymes. We don't know how to do that cleanly before there's enzymes. All of those pieces we don't know how to make, let alone hook together. Some people argue that since there's been hundreds of millions of years available, the probability that there's the chance that these things could happen in hundreds of millions of years. But that's not true. Time actually can be an enemy when it comes to organic synthesis. Prebiotic synthesis is before biology. So one has to make chemicals. Many of the chemicals that need to be made for life are kinetic products, meaning that they're not the most thermodynamically stable form. For example, carbohydrates, which is the main class of compounds. These are the units that hook together DNA. These are the units that have identifying aspects on cell structure. These are the units that the cell is going to need for the energy of life. Carbohydrates are kinetic products, meaning that if they should form, they would decompose. They decompose over time. And relatively short amounts of time, they decompose. The very reactions that make them, unless somebody is there to pull them out, to fish them out, to stop the process and put them in a bottle under inert conditions in a freezer, and not just one, there's many, many different types you have to do this, they end up going through a process of what's referred to as caramelization, meaning that they polymerize. They polymerize. The very aldol reactions that were used to make them just continue. And you get polyaldols, you get polycondensation reactions, and they caramelize.
Well, I don't know if you followed all that. Really important, though. We think, well, if we have an accidental assemblage of a few amino acids, we're heading toward a protein. No. Because they can form briefly, but they tend to disintegrate, like he was saying. Thermodynamics. A lot of the reactions that are necessary to create the building blocks of life are uphill thermodynamically. Reactions disintegrating those compounds are downhill. So you see more disintegration than you do creation. It's a huge problem. Nobody's found any way around it. Life gets around that by the use of what he referred to enzymes. We don't have time for that tonight. But back to this illustration. We could duplicate this building. You know, in New Jersey. We're going to build our version of the Taj Mahal. We're going to copy it stone for stone. It would cost a lot of money and take a lot of time, but we could do it. When it comes to the living cell, we can't even touch it. It is so far beyond anything that we have ever designed. We're practically clueless. Even the most rudimentary building blocks evade us. As Tour, and by the way, he's got, that's just a shorter clip of several longer lectures that you can get on YouTube. Just look up James Tour and get a fuller explanation. So, I put back to you again this proposition. If there's the presence of design, and I look at that original life, that is designed. That is not an accident. I would believe the Taj Mahal was an accident sooner than I would believe something that complex was an accident. And if we admit that there is design here, then that points us to the presence of a designer. A designer who is a thinker, who is a doer, who has intent, who's able to form a plan and execute it. Not a gas, not like gravity, some impersonal force, but a personal thinking being. That's the only kind of God that would give the answer, that would explain what we see. Well, so Peter says, you should be able to give people a reason for why you believe this. And I think it's really a good idea. You know, I listed about 10 different things to get in there and master a couple, three, four of those in case you get into a talk with somebody. And we should be able to explain, no, I don't just believe this because my parents did. As a matter of fact, for many of us, our parents are not believers. But there is reasonable basis for belief. And this is an important part to remember, too. Do it with gentleness and respect. Don't browbeat people. Don't attack. Share. Share what you've seen, what you've found. And that will be compelling for people. This God who created, you can get to know him. It's possible to have a personal relationship with him. Humans are the zenith of his creation. He created us in his own image with a soul that can commune with him. Jesus said in the book of Revelation, I knock at the door, and if anyone opens the door, I'll come in. So God is eager to have a relationship with you. He'll forgive you for everything you've ever done. He already paid for it at the cross. And you can know this God who created. You should really think about that. Yes, God, and we thank you for our awesome fellowship and friendships that we have here. We pray that we will be continuing to grow together in you. And we pray for a great time tonight watching the Buckeyes. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.